Welcome to the AR Show, where I dive deep into augmented reality with a focus on the technology, the use cases, and the people behind them. I'm your host, Jason McDowell. Today's conversation is with Alon Greenspun. Alon is the co-founder and CEO of Echo3D, a 3D-ready cloud platform that helps manage and deliver 3D, AR, and VR content to apps and devices everywhere. Echo3D recently closed a $4 million round of funding to feed continued growth after seeing a tremendous amount of momentum over the last year. Alon started his career in the Israeli intelligence service, working on encryption and cloud technologies. After earning a BS in computer science and electrical engineering from Tel Aviv University, he spent several years as a software engineer working on improving the performance of cloud-based and client-server computer systems. Alon went on to receive his MS in computer science from Columbia University with a focus on computer graphics, virtual and augmented reality, and human-computer interaction. In this conversation, we discuss how Alon's background made him a good fit for solving the unique set of challenges for developing an AWS or Akamai for 3D. Alon is a passionate entrepreneur with great advice for early stage startups. We talk about his perspective on the concept of founder market fit.
The reason that kind of we were able to grow really fast is that if you read the founder's resume, there's nothing else he can do. In my case, again, you're literally seeing that kind of connection. And I think, as you mentioned really well, that kind of founder market fit, I think a lot of people focus on product market fit, but the reason for you as a founder to create a startup, that you have this personal and professional connection to the problem, that you have the motivation of waking up in the morning and, you know, tackling this problem in the market, it needs to be really, really strong. And I think clients resonate with that, investors resonate with that, users resonate with that, potential employees resonate with that.
Alon goes on to discuss founder investor fit and the importance of pragmatically de-risking a startup as you go along. He also shares his funding and growth journey through the R Lab and Techstars accelerators and subsequent rounds of VC funding. As a reminder, you can find the show notes for this and other episodes at our website, thearshow.com. Let's dive in. Alon, like you, I love a good road trip. In fact, this past summer, I got to go on an epic road trip with my family. We're on the road for over 11,000 miles. We visited 39 states. It's pretty amazing in a lot of ways. What was one of your favorites?
Yeah, definitely. One of my best friends is actually my twin brother, who's also my co-founder at Echo. And we are known for doing the most amazing and epic road trips ever. I think our first one was driving a car from Denver to Las Vegas, stopping all these national parks. And it was a really, really cool experience, kind of definitely a bonding experience. But also for us as twins, kind of running around, specifically Las Vegas, people will always kind of jump at us like, it's, oh my God, it's like two of you. Something that we get all the time. People actually ask us to, to snap photos of us on the subway here in New York. So it's a really cool thing. Something I always tell people is get a twin. It's the best thing you can have, kind of a companion for your entire life. And if you're close friends enough to open a startup together, even better.
Twins, huh? So people are always snapping, trying to capture you two in the same place at the same time, just in this disbelief that you are not the same person.
Yeah, which kind of ties in beautifully to kind of what we do today at Echo, which is kind of the world of the AR, VR, the metaverse. Everyone wants a digital twin. I was fortunate enough to, get a real one.
Very nice. Very nice. Way back in the day, earlier in your career, you had a chance to spend some time with the Israeli intelligence service, which I think is really amazing. I know that in Israel, military service is a common part of growing up and becoming an adult, that part of the contribution. But you got to work with the Israeli intelligence service, working and leading a software development team. And this was even before you went to college.
Yeah.
Where did this kind of passion for your, for software development, even your literacy within software development kind of emerge for you as a young person?
Yeah, I love that question. I mean, as an Israeli American, I mean, every kind of Israeli goes through that process. When people go to kind of spring break, most Israelis just enroll to the Israeli army. It's a really kind of humbling, but also maturing experience. For me, I knew early on that I really loved computer science and I really loved programming. I kind of double majors and kind of in CS in high school. And it was like, that's the thing that I want to really, really do. And serving in the intelligence corps really gives you the opportunity to basically get like on-job training, lead a team if you're good enough, and basically kind of explore really, really innovative computer science concepts and things around coding and cybersecurity. That was basically my first introduction to kind of client-server communications and kind of a hint from the intelligence community, encrypted data as well. which again kind of kickstarted my process of like going into the world of cloud and network infrastructure. So I was definitely very grateful for that. And I also think it's a really interesting experience if you think about the people who are the equivalent to what I did back in the day when I was 18. Here in the US, these are people who are 50-year-olds in the NSA. So it kind of gives you kind of a head start on what do you like? Where do you want to go? What is the kind of field of specification that you want to really focus on? For me, it was definitely cloud and was definitely kind of computer science. And I was fortunate enough, again, to kind of know that early on.
So because you had that understanding of yourself, you ended up then going on to Tel Aviv University and studying that. As you know, you got a BS in electrical computer engineering, computer science. And then you went on to join a startup that worked in a number of these cloud-related technologies. I think that company was acquired by NVIDIA at some point in the process where there. Is that right?
Yeah. So that was like my first job was working at Mellanox, one of the biggest software companies in Israel. I think last year was kind of acquired by NVIDIA. They were a global company. I think their choice was between and kind of, I think they were already IPO. I think it was like a post-IPO acquisition. But again, most of the things I did there were client-server communication, low-latency communication. And this is something that, again, kind of really is core to my character in a sense, like I really wanted to figure out what's going on under the hood, what's going on in kind of the invisible stuff that when we're talking about computers, which is cloud, which is networking, which is streaming. And we'll talk about that later. But then when I got into the world of AR, VR, metaverse, 3D, these are actually the most hyper-visual stuff that you can see. So kind of bridging those things together is something that I'm really, really passionate about, kind of connecting the invisible stuff and the visible stuff. And there's super, super interesting challenges there, specifically when we're talking about 3D content.
Yeah, connecting the visible to the invisible.
Which is probably what the metaverse is all about, right? Like kind of creating that invisible layer that's kind of there. So again, brief component of that.
Yeah. So you ended up then making your way to New York. How is it that you kind of found your way to studying computer science at Columbia and finding your way into augmented reality?
Yeah, so my story definitely starts on the Microsoft store on Fifth Ave. So if you're ever in New York, Microsoft has an experience store on Fifth Avenue. I went there with my dad, and they had an HTC Vive headset there, basically that everyone can kind of use. I put it on, and then my life was literally changed. I played Tilt Brush. I literally pinged around me, firebended. It was the most surreal experience. That moment was that moment that I felt, oh my God, like I found my calling. I love this. I want to be a part of this. The same way how I was super passionate about like understanding what's happening under the hood when it came to cloud infrastructure. Suddenly I want to understand how do you do computer graphics? How do you create these hyper-visual experiences? I was blown away. And then that kind of really pushed me to apply to the master's program at Columbia University. I knew that there is a professor there, Professor Stephen Feiner, who is a seminal researcher in the world of AR, VR, 3D, and human-computer interactions. I said, I want to do a thesis with the guy. I went to his office. I was like, I'm going to do a thesis with you. Like, it's a thing. He's like, let's start with the project. Regardless, it was an amazing experience. My time at Columbia really gave me that understanding of, okay, this is what you can do with 3D. This is where the world is going. Here's this amazing lab and these amazing researchers when it comes to AR and VR. And my specification when it came to cloud felt really needed in that world. And that's where my journey kind of started.
Yeah. So tell me about that. How did this concept and motivation around Echo 3D emerge there from those studies and that passion, the past experience you had all kind of mixing together inside of you?
When I did my thesis project back at Columbia University, we did this AR for surgery application. Tagline was AR for the OR. It was a really cool experience. We took CT and MRI scans, converted them into 3D, then put them on the Microsoft HoloLens, this kind of high-end smart glasses by Microsoft. And the physician was basically able to see the patient's heart floating above them during surgery. It was an amazing experience. I got the chance to scrub into over 10 surgeries. It was completely surreal. Definitely as a kind of Israeli-American kid, no one even checked my ID. You just walk into the OR and they start drilling. Really, really amazing experience. But the problem was that in order to do that, I honestly had to do something I really, really hate. And that's waking up super early in the morning. I had to be in the OR at Columbia Medical at like 6 a.m. to take those kind of 2D scans, convert them to 3D models, put them on the HoloLens, recompile the application that was written in Unity, by the way, for all the technical listeners. And that process was so frustrating and took so much time. And for me as a developer, while it was cool to be in the OR in general, what am I doing here? Like anyone can drag and drop a 3D asset, some kind of heart or aorta, and then have that stream into the device. But we didn't find a really good solution for that to basically allow you to manage and deliver 3D content to AR devices. And then me and my co-founders started to basically interviewing people, specifically in the Columbia University lab that kind of handles a lot of AR VR projects. but other projects, not just surgical ones, the one to talk about gaming and training and data visualization and e-commerce. And basically, they all said the same thing, that there is really no easy way to manage and deliver 3D content. And then we looked at the past. Well, you don't need to be a web developer to update a blog post, right? You can drag and drop an image or video. Suddenly, that appears in web and mobile. We went through this evolution from web to mobile to now AR, VR, 3D, immersive, call it whatever. And we have the solutions for 2D content, for images and videos. So we ask ourselves, like, who's going to be, you know, the next cloud platform for this new type of content? And you're looking at it or listening at it at this point.
How did you at that time, as you're just getting started, how did you articulate the vision for the company, the problem you're trying to solve, and kind of where you're going to go with it?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, because always the first articulation of a problem and solution is really bad. It takes so much kind of iteration to kind of figure out how to kind of tell your message, specifically when you're in a startup setting, or even like any product manager who's listening probably has the same thing. How do you kind of communicate your message of like what the product needs to be? So in the beginning, we really found that we need to create, and kind of hold your breath here, server-side solution for 3D applications. Not a kind of catchy tagline, but then we realized that kind of a lot of, again, my passion back in the day from cloud infrastructure and client-server communication that I had in the Israeli Army or during undergrad or doing my work in NVIDIA needs to kind of be implemented in the world of 3D. And then we kind of talked to a lot of people. I think we did over, again, 300 quote-unquote customer discovery interviews, and then we came about kind of the phrasing of cloud platform, which kind of resonated well with people and really was expected similar to how those solutions exist in 2D for images and videos. And that's how we started the process.
So this notion, you've talked kind of throughout the conversation so far about this passion that you discovered for kind of the cloud-related technologies, understanding how things work under the hood. You spend a lot of time understanding and refining how data moves across the web, the internet, how it's being transported in terms of encryption and how to make it more optimized as it's moving as well. This fits really well to this other problem you discovered as it relates to AR, which is, well, we have this new type of asset, 3D content, and there isn't really a good solution for this particular asset type within, you know, the world of 3D, within the world of AR. And this seems like a really good fit for you and your background specifically. Do you think that this notion of founder market fit impacts the success of the startup? How does that end up playing out, do you think, over the course of a startup?
100%. I think the reason that kind of we were able to grow really fast is that if you read the founder's resume, there's nothing else he can do. In my case, again, you're literally seeing that kind of connection. And I think, as you mentioned really well, that kind of founder market fit. I think a lot of people will focus on product market fit, but the reason for you as a founder to create a startup, that you have this personal and professional connection to the problem, that you have the motivation of waking up in the morning and, you know, tackling this problem in the market, it needs to be really, really strong. And I think clients resonate with that, investors resonate with that, users resonate with that, potential employees resonate with that. The fact that the problem that you're trying to solve is something that you're really passionate about is really, really important. And I think it's key to a lot of successful startups that you see today. I mean, I can't even think of a startup that, you know, I don't see a really strong founder market fit between the CEO, the originator of the startup, to the actual problem that they're trying to solve.
So you don't advise that a founder, just because they have a good idea on how to solve something that they don't live every day and feel every day, you don't advise them to go and jump in and just do it anyway?
I would advise them to start becoming the person that could solve that problem. Interview, talk to as many people as you can, become an expert at the problem that you want to solve. And then you have those credentials of basically saying, yeah, there's a kind of founder market fit. You don't have to kind of be born with it, right? But definitely it requires work. If you have a great idea and you think that you can revolutionize industry X, become an expert in industry X, talk to as many people that you can, and really kind of try to understand those problems, again, personally and professionally.
What is the practical, tactical implication of having that level of insight, having that sort of founder market fit?
I think, again, it goes back to how you tell your story. I think stories are extremely important. The reason that, you know, people listen to podcasts, they want to kind of join into the conversation. And the minute that you are able to establish yourself as a kind of credible source, any conversation that you'll have in your entrepreneurial journey, if it's with clients or, again, investors or potential hirees, it all becomes much, much easier. Because even if I'm talking to someone who's not an expert in AR, but in the first, you know, minute they realize that I am, the conversation is much easier and I'm able to kind of bring them into the world of AR much easily.
Is there any implication on the decision-making process, how you structure the time that you're going to be spending with the limited resources that you have?
I would say that, you know, the way everything is really hectic in the beginning when you're a startup, you're really trying to kind of juggle all these things. But I think in general, the thing that makes a startup successful is the team and the commitment and the passion for the product. Again, what we said earlier, the fact that I wake up in the morning and have that kind of passion for this industry that I think I found a problem and I want to solve it and kind of be first to market or be kind of, or like kind of providing that value to our customers, I think is super, super important. So one of the things that I think, again, is not talked enough when it comes to kind of entrepreneurship and startups is the kind of notion of de-risking. You as a founder, what you're constantly doing all the time is de-risking your venture in the eyes of investors, clients, anything. So every time you're kind of doing any decision in your startup, it's really, again, a point for you to make your startup more credible. If it's through your personal background, like we said about kind of your founder market fit, or through your product, or through your customer interviews, at the end, when you're going, where as an entrepreneur, if you're applying to an accelerator or you're talking to investors, at the end, they want to see that this is not a risky investment. And you can definitely assure them that that's the case. And I think a lot of the action that you're doing in your startup, and again, it could be a vast things that you can do, is around de-risking your startup.
As you look back to 2018, and you're just getting this off the ground, what did you see at that time as some of the biggest risks that the startup was facing? And how did you kind of go about de-risking that company in those first couple of years?
I can tell you that even last year, we had around 300 users on our platform. Today, we have over 12,000. So how do you achieve that growth? How do you kind of go about it? So I think in the beginning, it was all about trying to figure out where our users are coming from, how can we organically bring more and more users into our platform, and was also about kind of going through the bottom-up approach, what I believe is the right kind of approach for startups, talking to as much as people as you can, constantly, going through an accelerated program. In the beginning, we went through an accelerated program with our lab at NYC Media Lab that really kind of supports early stage founders. After that, we went through Techstars, one of the most amazing accelerators in the country. We got investments from angels. After that, we did the kind of VC round. 2 weeks ago, we did another VC round with a bigger fund. So I think this is, again, it kind of seems really natural, that kind of bottom-up approach, like understanding your market, scaling up, as opposed to what we see in the industry that some people just blitz funding, let's raise billions of dollars for something that we've never tested. I'm a big believer of the kind of lean startup methodology that basically, again, starts from bottom-up and scales up. And I think it's the right way to de-risk your startup, to kind of show validation. If you're talking to investors today, 6 months from now, you're going to be in a different place and they're going to see you through that journey. So I think that's really, really important.
You noted that a year ago, you were sitting at about 300 or so customers engaging with the platform, and now you're at 12,000. That's a tremendous amount of growth over the course of 12 months. Was there something about the product itself that you were learning that needed to change or evolve that ended up contributing to that growth?
Yeah, so I think definitely kind of understanding of the user journey inside the product, how do we need to orient it to kind of work. But I think the biggest metric that we had is time to hello world. So this is basically how much time it takes for someone who registers to Echo to build an app. And we really, really, really tried to minimize that metric to say that it should be easy, 15 seconds or less, 15 minutes or less, but not an hour. And even if you're a non-techie, how easy it is for you to deploy AR content with no technical skills. So these are the things that we really, really kind of focused on the product and made sure that we can really quantify that. And that seemed to work. The fact that you can register to Echo today, 15 seconds later, see AR on your phone with no kind of app installation is something that kind of really, really resonates with our users. And also the quick integrations that we have with kind of third-party technologies, like Echo is a verified solution with Unity, one of the biggest game engines in the world. The fact that you can drag and drop the Unity SDK that Echo has, click play, suddenly models stream out of thin air. And it's all, again, it's literally a matter of minutes. So that's one of the core kind of values that we believe in. How can we help developers build faster?
Yeah, so this kind of time to realization of value was really a key area that we're focused on. It was sounds like less about kind of the core value within the platform around being able to manage and serve content, wherever it happens to be, convert content. We'll talk a bit more about that as well. But it's really about how they understood and were able to access that value as quickly as possible.
100%.
Yeah. And you noted the market's really responded positively to this 300 to 12,000. Was there a contributing factor around COVID? How did you manage kind of that piece of the extra externality, I guess, in the puzzle of, you know, trying to grow over that time?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think there's multiple factors here. One is definitely the fact that Zoom or video interaction is the new normal. So everyone is trying to kind of find what's the next thing. So it might be 3D content, it might be holograms, you name it. And also the fact that like everyone's at home, they're exactly in a sense where I want them to be, right? Marketing wise, they're sitting in front of a computer waiting to build. So our kind of marketing campaigns were really effective and our go-to-market worked really well because of that. And I think also if you think about like what we had with like really big companies kind of pushing hardware everywhere. So AR ready hardware, VR hardware, the Oculus Quest sells out almost, you know, like it's cheaper and sells out more than any console out there. Every phone out there has AR capabilities built in. Apple, Google, they're all adding, you know, cameras, which I look at as AR sensors, to their hardware to kind of push you to buy their phone. So that kind of also helped with like suddenly there's a proliferation of AR hardware out there, which definitely kind of, you know, brings the question, okay, the platforms are there. Now people want to build something on it. And Echo could be that tool for that.
How is it now that you've evolved? You spent 3 years refining both the product and also your storytelling around the product. How do you describe what your vision is today? How do you describe the company today?
Yeah. So we're today kind of, our vision has become the number one server-side solution for 3D. Basically, we're building the AWS for 3D or the Akamai for 3D, basically becoming that go-to tool for 3D development. If you think about it again today, what Echo does is we provide tools and infrastructure for companies and developers who want to build 3D applications. And that could be games, it could be AR, VR applications, it could be any 3D experience that you can think of. And what we want to get to is the point, and it's very similar to what we said earlier, that you don't need to be a web developer to update a blog post. You drag and drop some image or video and it works. The same needs to apply for 3D. The fact that today, if we're looking at any 3D experience that you can think of, let's think of the biggest social network today, Fortnite, that people who are younger than you and me are fully immersed in that, playing around with it. There's not a lot of user-generated content. There's no drag and drop that I can kind of drop something to Fortnite and then tomorrow drag that to Roblox and then put it on my phone. And the reason for that, again, the way I see it is just the under-the-hood stuff are not kind of well-defined. There's not a lot of network capabilities. There's not a lot of like content management tools. And that's what we're trying to kind of revolutionize in this space, allowing for 3D content to be much more easy to manage, much more easy to distribute it, and making sure that you don't have to handle any server setup or any kind of technical optimizations for that to just work everywhere in any network.
Why is 3D content different? Why isn't Akamai or AWS good enough for the 3D world?
That's my favorite question. If you think about images or videos, you as Jason, you can't move an image or a video on a website. But you can definitely move a 3D couch across a room. So that needs to be updated in the cloud. 3D content is much more localized and much more spatial than just 2D content. And also the file format is so different. If you think about, again, image or video, it's a single file. But in 3D, you can have the texture and then the mesh and the animation and all these different, and the skeleton of the model. And all these different things can be hundreds of files sometimes if you have a lot of textures, but they actually consider like one single entity. And that is something that we don't have, like kind of logic, we don't have in 2D at all. The location, the change, having a model, but then having different textures to it, basically different variants, something that kind of only exists in 3D. And another thing I'll say is just these kind of, there's no standard out there. Apple only works with the USDZ file format. Web works really well with GLBs. Unity works with FBX. So all these different platforms are trying to kind of create their own format. We're going to pick a horse. And in my case, we don't bet on the horse, we bet on the track. Use any platform. You can upload stuff to Echo. Every format will convert to any format. We will decimate every 3D model to kind of smaller version of it. So you'll be able to stream it in different network environments. And you'll be able to change things remotely without doing a lot of technical work. And I think the fact that 3D models, again, are sometimes are so kind of large even, like you can have a kind of a collection of files that's like 100 megabytes. How do you stream that to a mobile device really rapidly? That's definitely a challenge. So with Echo, we do those kind of automatic conversions and compressions, and it just works.
It just works. If somebody wasn't going to use Echo 3D, what else would they do? How else do people solve this problem today?
So the same way, if you can ask yourself, I want to build a website, but I don't want to use AWS. So kind of good luck of setting up a server, hooking up to kind of a DNS provider, trying to kind of make sure that it connects to the internet, that it can establish different loads, a few users coming in. Yeah, that's definitely a challenge. Like, for you, I mean, it's possible you can kind of recreate the wheel every time, and every company can kind of recreate their own. But we really focus on creating a really generic solution for every use case that you can connect your application to the cloud and start streaming data really rapidly.
You'd mentioned a couple of these already, but maybe you can restate them. Yeah. What are the top few features that developers value most on the platform?
Today, it's the easy, it's kind of how easy it is to store, manage, and deliver 3D content. So when you upload data to Echo, easily accessible, you can share all the models that you have with anyone in the world. And then you're able to kind of basically stream it automatically across different platforms. So if you want to jump from Android to iOS to Magic Leap to Unity, you can do that really quickly. The content is yours. You're not vendor locked to use a specific platform. And you don't have to, again, reinvent the wheel every time you want to kind of port your application somewhere else. And also, that kind of content management aspect of it kind of decouples the software production from the content creation. A kind of developer can focus on developing, and a non-technical team member can drag and drop 3D assets, and suddenly they appear in web, mobile, AR, VR, you name it. And I think that is something that we kind of really take for granted when it comes to 2D content. Like, we know the roles like social media manager exist. What are these roles in 3D, in the world of 3D content? How do we empower those people as well to inject 3D content to different platforms? And as we kind of look to the future, how do we allow user-generated content to be kind of shared automatically between users and between platforms and between games?
Users, platforms, games. What are kind of the top few use cases for the products that are being built on your platform? Is it primarily games, or are there other types of content as well?
Fortunately, we're really getting a bird's eye view of what people are building with Echo, building and streaming. So we actually can see what content is doing well. So definitely, I would say the biggest protocols that we're seeing right now are games, e-commerce, that also encapsulates NFTs, and advertisements. So these are kind of the big three that we're seeing. People either use Unity or web or kind of native mobile to achieve that. And I think, again, it's really, really exciting. One of the things that, if you think about it, back in the day when websites were all the rage, people would ask, what do you need a website for? And now it's obvious that, you know, you can use a website to create a social network or a e-commerce website. 5 years later, you have the same thing. People ask, what do you need a mobile app for? And now you have dating apps and ride-hailing apps. 5 years after, so we went from web to mobile to that new technology, which is AR, VR, 3D immersive. We basically ask ourselves, like, what can you do with it? And we're fortunate enough, again, to have that realization and get that bird's eye view of what people are actually building and become that place that will inspire creators to build whatever they want. They're limited only by their imagination.
So you have games, e-commerce, and advertising.
Exactly.
Do you anticipate that those three will kind of continue to be the main three? How do you imagine this will evolve over the next handful of years?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think even a few years ago, I wouldn't even imagine that NFTs would become such a big vertical, and like digital assets, kind of selling of digital assets online would be such a strong kind of trend. Which again, that's why I'm a big proponent of like not betting on the horse, but rather betting on a track. Use Echo for whatever. If NFTs are your thing, you do you. I am personally leaning towards games being a really, really large vertical. I think games are becoming more, the term game needs to kind of be redefined in a sense, because we're seeing something like Fortnite, which is a game. But if we look at it closely, it's actually a social network. People jump in to talk to their friends, talk with kind of different avatars. I think games will at some point will also become like e-commerce experience. You can kind of shop around in a virtual store. Brands are already injecting ads into kind of 3D environments, so that kind of ties into advertisements. And I think maybe kind of the encapsulating term that a lot of people are trying to kind of push today is like metaverse, which is kind of fitting because we are creating this kind of digital universe that we're trying to kind of build. And we hope that Echo could be that kind of ether of the metaverse, that kind of connecting invisible thread between everything, that you're able to share data, stream data, connect to data remotely. And hopefully that kind of answers your question.
So all of this momentum, again, you talked about going from 300 or so customers about a year ago or so, up to 12,000 now. So all this momentum has really contributed to this recent fundraise. You know, just a couple of weeks back, you'd closed another round. I think it was around from 4 million or so.
Yeah.
How did you kind of manage this fundraising process from home during COVID? How was that for you?
That's a great question. It's hard. I mean, again, 5 years ago, it might not have been imaginable to fundraise remotely. You know, fundraising with people that usually you want like a really personal connection with, now you can't even meet them. It definitely provides opportunities for people around the world to kind of realize that now there's more opportunity to fundraise because you can literally fundraise from everywhere. You don't have to be just on the coasts. They usually kind of most VC funding goes to. So that's definitely, definitely great. I love our new investors from Convoy Ventures, who kind of led the previous round, and also Space Capital, who joined, and Reimagine Ventures, who I'm obsessed with them. They invested in our previous round as well. And also we went through Techstars, as I mentioned. We got grants from Y Combinator and NYC Media Lab, and you know, angels from GitHub and Datadog and Facebook. This is a really cool collection of people that kind of share the same vision that you and I are talking about around 3D and the metaverse. So for you as a founder or someone who kind of is looking to kind of fundraise, definitely realize that now you're closer than ever to people because you can talk to them remotely. And also you have kind of, you know, more people that you can share your vision with. And it might be that your perfect investor, like I'm in New York, apparently my perfect investor was in Colorado. And now even without kind of physically meeting, we can kind of lead around. And in general, I'll also say that when I met them in person for the first time after we closed, wow, they're much taller than I imagined.
One of the many surprises, I think, that
the Zoom has.
The Zoom world you know, enables us to have these kind of delightful moments. Oh, wait, man, you are different than I imagined. As you kind of thought through the process, and to the extent that you're able to be very picky about who you ultimately selected to be as part of, you know, be an investment partner for you, how did you kind of think through that process? Why were the few investors that you mentioned the right group for you?
That's a great question. So we already kind of mentioned product market fit, and we talked about founder market fit. Now let's talk about founder investor fit. This is definitely another concept that is kind of under discussed. And this is something you kind of need to realize. You are going on a journey with these people. They're investing in your company for the long run. In our case, we again want to IPO is the AWS of 3D. In order to have that, you need to have partners who understand that. Like, you need to have people who are aligned on your vision, on where you want to go. And it's hard. Like, when you're doing it as a founder, it's more than just like, you know, adding money to your bank account. It's more about finding the right people that can help you accomplish that vision. When you start out as a kind of as a founder, every investor that adds you on LinkedIn, you're like, oh my God, googly eyes. And it's like, oh my God, they're going to invest in my company. But that's never the case. Like, the same way you chose a specific startup to build, they chose a specific VC firm to establish. Like, they have a thesis, they have something that they're interested in. So you need to find those people that are interested in the same thing they're interested with. I mean, it's going to be no surprise to anyone to know that Convoy Ventures invests a lot of games and network infrastructure. So that's why they kind of chose to invest in Echo. It would be surprising to hear that maybe someone in the consumer tech space invested in a company that does, I don't know, medical devices, right? You have to find the right investor that, again, going back to what we said, that you have that personal and professional connection with, and that you're very aligned on where you want to go together. And for every founder listening, you have to find the kind of the people that it makes sense for you to appear in their portfolio. When I met Reimagine Ventures, when I met Convoy, when I met Space, I was like, okay, our logo needs to be on that portfolio page. Like, it's so clear to me there's a fit. So try to kind of look at that from that perspective and find that kind of founder investor fit. If that's not a fit, that's totally fine. Move on to the next one. There's amazing people out there.
What's the implication? What happens if there isn't good founder investor fit?
I think investors, again, they're partners, they're active members in your startup. It's more than just, here's the money, remember to send us updates. The interest they can provide, the network effect they can kind of establish, the people that they connect you with, they need to be relevant. Like when we went through our due diligence process and we kind of, you know, discussed our vision, we were like, who are the people that we want to target? Who are the customers that we want to bring in? And then we realized, oh, this investor can make this intro. Oh, this guy knows this. They can kind of work together. They have a portfolio company that work together. Maybe we can work with them as well and kind of create a partnership. These are really kind of, again, forward-thinking concept that you need to figure out with your investors before kind of, you know, before they sign the check.
Along the way, you mentioned that some of these have been with you for a couple of rounds. You also mentioned a couple of accelerators there on the list. One of them was R Lab, which I think is in partnership with NYU. Mm-hmm. And Ori Inbar is involved in that. And we know Ori from AWE and other past experiences. But you participated in R Lab. And then you'd also mentioned Techstars. How did these accelerators fit into your continued growth, evolution, understanding of who you are and where you're going as a company?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for you as a startup, again, that tries to de-risk, you're trying to get a lot of supporters throughout the way. And for us, that process was perfect. We started up with the kind of accelerator at our lab that was really focused on the industry, right? For us as a startup in the XR world. And that was really highly industry specific on 3D, AR, VR, and bringing those connections together. After that, we went through Techstars. That was a more kind of general program. It really focused from you as a company, as a startup, as opposed to like an AR startup. We had companies in our Techstars class that, you know, did fintech or SaaS or even legal tech. They're really, really an amazing kind of variety of startups. And the amazing thing that you learn in Techstars is that kind of how strong the network can be and how valuable you can make your startup. I mean, no wonder that Techstars company are IPOing like mad at this point. I think there was like three just in the last month or something. It's a really amazing program that kind of trains you to be an entrepreneur. For me, again, if we go back to my personal background, I was an engineer. I know how to write code. It's really different to run a company. It's really different to hire, to fundraise, like all these things that no one taught me in college. So now when you have these kind of support system, and you're sitting with founders that can kind of, you know, everyone is in the same boat, and you have mentors like Ori Anbar, for example, that can really, really kind of help you out and kind of brainstorm ideas. I think it's really, really valuable. But also do that bottom-up approach. Start with a industry-specific program, then move to kind of wider company-level program, and then continue on to, again, angels and VC and so on and so forth.
So that process kind of built for you from being very industry product focused to being more company building focused to each round is a little bit broader in its perspective, the perspective that the investors, the partners, the accelerators, whoever's involved is able to contribute to the company.
Exactly, exactly. Again, I'm a big believer of that process of going bottom up and kind of scaling upwards. No one would be surprised that like you don't start the IPO, right? There's a long way there.
So in this spirit of building from the bottom up, now that you've closed this round of financing, what does the next stage of growth look like? Where are you building next?
So now we're hiring like mad. I mean, if I focused on fundraising for a few months now, my sole focus is on hiring, expanding the team, making more and more supporters on board to make sure that we can kind of bring our you know, cloud platform for more and more developers out there. We're hiring VP of sales and head of developer relations and people around marketing and engineers, obviously. Yeah, I mean, I think that's even for us, you kind of to grow as a team. I think it's kind of a big challenge, but it's also super exciting because, again, that's the reason I wake up in the morning.
Fantastic. As we reflect back on the fundraising process, what were some of your key takeaways as you kind of put it all together? What advice would you share with another founder who's setting out on their own path?
I would definitely say be patient, be responsive, and look for those kind of key metrics for a founder investor fit. There are, or also maybe even investor market fit, now that I think about it, like there are investors that I talked to that was clear from the first conversation that it's not a fit. These are perfectly nice people, but they don't know about 3D or gaming or AR VR content, or I'm the first to ever show them AR. So yeah, they're probably not going to be the expert, or they're probably not going to have the kind of, you know, industry connections to take our company to the next level. And from your end as a founder, kind of can understand the roles, like understand what's going on with the VC firms. I think that's something that, again, as a founder, you're not really aware of, but they're raising from LPs. They have their internal process. They have their metrics that they want to hit. They want your company to be aligned with their kind of ROI strategy. Ask about that. Kind of make sure that you're aligned. If you're a company and you are building something that you believe can create a specific return, but they're looking to 10x that return, maybe that's not a fit. So I think it's definitely kind of to align yourself and, again, de-risk your startup in their eyes and make sure that you're, again, super aligned on the vision of the company.
You talk about this notion of de-risking, kind of leading to this point, but now there's still risk, right, in front of you as you look ahead and work towards this next phase, the next milestone, major milestones in the company. What do you see? What are you most concerned about, I guess, inside the company? What are you trying to de-risk over the next 12 to 18 months?
So now it ties back to hiring. We want to get more and more amazing people, amazing supporters in our company to help kind of accelerate the processes that we already have. This obviously de-risks it because then you have more hands on deck, more people to kind of expose the company to new ideas. So that definitely de-risks it. It gives more opportunity for kind of more people to contribute. So that definitely helps de-risking it. But also, I think the fact that we were able to kind of really automate a lot of the current processes, like we still get between 100 and 200 developers registered every week through online ads and online marketing and stuff like that, and developer evangelism. So these things need to continue, right? Like, and that is kind of the double-edged sword of being a startup. Every time you succeed, it's always, okay, what's next? And kind of the goalpost always moves back, and the finish line kind of, it's always in the horizon. So as long as you kind of accept that reality, and that doesn't depress you, but rather kind of makes you optimistic, like, oh my God, there's so much to do. And every time you level up, there's all these new things to learn. Perfect. I mean, personally, before this, I never ran a company, never fundraised, never built a kind of a fully kind of autonomous product. But these are, again, that bottom-up approach that you get to one milestone, let's get to the other, and the previous one helps you get there. I think I personally see it as something super, super exciting.
As you look outside of the company,
yeah,
what is your biggest concern across the market more generally?
I think everyone's kind of waiting for Apple to release their AR glasses. Like everyone's kind of looking to see what the big players would do. The way I look at it is I'm super optimistic. Like it's obvious that it's going to kind of happen real soon. Like that kind of spike in the world of AR, the spike in VR. We are looking at Facebook, the companies that in front of our eyes is transforming itself to a metaverse company, to a hardware company when it comes to VR. We're seeing every hardware manufacturer adds more and more cameras to their devices, hiring AR VR engineers like mad. I think it was, I don't remember the name of the firm, but they basically showed that AR VR roles grew like 1,000% or something like that in last year. And another thing that kind of gives me real hope is, again, younger generations, they're using camera-first applications like mad. People who are younger than me are fully immersed in camera-first applications like TikTok and Snapchat. I don't see them graduating back to 2D interfaces. I don't see them swiping a 2D feed. And that's what gives me hope, because I think we're going to use more, like even more 3D content. We'll have even more spatial aware apps. So that's my kind of, you know, reason to be optimistic.
Fair enough. I love all the underlying signals that indicate that what we see now is just the beginning of an even larger embracing of 3D types of content.
100%.
But I will provide a counterpoint.
Yeah.
That we've never abandoned 2D, and I don't imagine that we will abandon 2D, because there are some things where 2D is the right type of interface. The paper we have, you know, that we print on, that we read in books.
I would say that we abandoned, and things are changing. It's always a pendulum, but think about phones, right? So we can say that at some point we abandoned voice for text. And after text, we abandoned text for kind of images and kind of sending even memes or just like kind of using cameras and stuff like that. And now we're abandoning that for FaceTime and video and Snapchat and TikTok. So it's still there. It's not like those features kind of disappeared, but how the majority of people interact. And I think the distinction is definitely clear. I think the next thing would be 3D content in some capacity. After that, who knows? Again, let your imagination run wild. But I definitely think there's kind of an evolution of content. And yeah, maybe we don't, again, maybe nothing kind of dies, but it definitely dies down.
It seems that we're on a constant march in our efforts through electronic communication to recreate the physical communication experience, right? That started with the telegraph, it evolves to the telephone, that sticks around for a very long time before we can evolve that to some other sort of electronic means, which is really going back to the telegraph and sending text messages. We bring back the voice, and then we add the video. It's all kind of this march towards how do we recreate the personal physical interaction? And 3D, of course, is an important part of that journey. How do we recreate that even with higher fidelity? But there is, in my opinion, this other deeper underlying motivation. What is the underlying intention behind communication? It is for my human brain to be able to transmit into your human brain what it is that I'm thinking or feeling in this moment. And so who knows how that actually ends up playing out over the longer term in terms of, you know, how and where that communication takes place between our different minds. But today there's lots of intermediary steps in that process. Anyway,
100%. I love it. Also, I mean, there's kind of a rabbit hole here that we can kind of dive into in the world of kind of human computer interaction, or maybe even brain computer interaction at some point. But I think you're 100% true. Like people are trying to find a way to interact with others and engage, and that the kind of technological march that we're going through is really finding what is the best way to interact. What is the best way for human computer interaction or human to human interaction through computers? Think about how big was the kind of jump in the iPhone moment that suddenly there's touch screens. And that kind of became the standard. That is better than a keyboard. And I think a lot of people just kind of see what we have today, like using a mouse or like a keyboard. before that, you had, and these are something that you can see in kind of human-computer interaction, like in Professor Stephen's lab, Professor Stephen Feiner's lab at Columbia, that does research on human-computer interaction, dials that were used instead of a mouse. But then a mouse became a better solution for computer interaction. Same thing we're going on right now. You see the Oculus Quest, what was it, last year, we had controllers. A few software updates later, we have hand recognition instead. Still both work, but we're constantly kind of trying to find what's the best way to interact with content in 3D. There's a bunch of questions, again, that I love to kind of confront with. How do you search something in 3D? How do you select something? Again, going back to my work at the computer graphics lab in Columbia with Professor Stephen Feiner, these are questions that are kind of literally answered through research. Like, what is the best interaction to rotate something? When we did that kind of thesis project with the surgeries, we allowed physicians to have two types of interaction. One is with kind of hand gestures, like moving around, but also voice to tell the heart to rotate, to tell the aorta to spin. And what is better? I don't know. We need to figure out that. That was kind of our research to find out what is the best interaction. But these are so, again, exciting. Like, we are so used to 2D screens, the exit kind of button is here, the enlarge button is there. But what will we have in 3D? How do you select something? How do you grab something? Should it be one-to-one like we have in the world? Like, I need to physically grab something, or can I use, again, some kind of brain, kind of telekinesis almost, or something like that we see in Marvel movies? I'm definitely a proponent of the latter. The more sci-fi becomes reality, the better.
It's a really fun and exciting time, definitely, to be involved in this area of technology, because it does feel like this next wave is going to be the most personal, the most human of all of the technology waves we've had so far.
I couldn't agree more.
Let's wrap up with a few enlightening round questions here. What commonly held belief about spatial computing, about AR and VR and 3D, do you disagree with?
Again, I think I disagree with kind of a lot of people's notion about kind of the rate of adoption. I think a lot of people would look at AR and VR like, oh, why didn't it happen? Or it's like face filters are all over the place and no one calls it AR, but that's face tracking and with AR. So I think a lot of the people are really missing kind of small markers of what's going on with kind of society and what's going on with like younger generations, how they interact with content, and kind of have not the right estimation about the market, which I'm super kind of bullish about.
So you're saying that even though on the surface it may seem like AR is emerging slowly, under the surface there's all sorts of great indicators that the underlying technologies are making tremendous strides.
Yeah, I mean, open your Amazon app and literally have a button to almost every product to kind of see an AR and try before you buy. That's already there.
Yeah. Besides the one you're building, what tool or service do you wish existed in the AR market?
So one story I always tell is that during Techstars, there's this kind of mentor madness session that you basically talk a lot with mentors, and we kind of try to figure out how they can help us, how we can kind of create value from the program. And one of those mentors was a banker. And I was, okay, this conversation, this is not going to be fruitful. He's a banker. I'm doing AR, VR. How does that even relate? But I was like optimistic. I tried to find a kind of way to kind of extract value. And then I asked him, what is the biggest issue that you have in the banking world? And he said, well, we have all these banking apps. They're all exactly the same. I can't convince the younger generations to use my bank and our mobile experience as opposed to others while all these kind of branches, physical branches, are closing down. And then I was like, what do you think if you can swipe left on your banking app, uncover a camera, and suddenly a virtual ATM pops up and you can do all these transactions in a virtual AR ATM. Will that be something that you think younger generations will love to kind of gamify the banking experience? And he said, yes. So when I think of like the things that are missing are so not obvious, just talk to anyone in any industry that doesn't have AR today and figure out how AR can improve them. And I think in banking, which is again, such a non-obvious example, suddenly when you think about it, like 5 minutes in, it's like, oh my God, this could really revolutionize this industry. So I'm a big proponent of like, talk to as many people as you can, find a person who's like in a non-obvious industry, think for 5 minutes how AR could be integrated into that industry, and you'll find literally magic.
What book have you read recently that you found to be deeply insightful or profound?
There's a book called The Five Temptations of a CEO. Super, super short book that basically kind of gives you a quick rundown of like do's and don'ts that I would really recommend kind of CEO founders.
Awesome. Do you remember who the author is on that?
I have it right here. I can definitely check. Patrick
Lencioni?
Yeah, Patrick Lencioni, exactly.
Oh, dude, that guy's a genius.
And it's such a short book, kind of easy dive. It was recommended to me by Easy Vidra, board member and managing director at Reimagine Ventures. which is, again, another value that you can extract from your investors. Good book recommendations. So definitely check it out.
Last one here. If you could sit down and have coffee with your 25-year-old self, what advice would you share with 25-year-old Alon?
What advice? I would say, again, talk to as many people as you can. Like, you're on the right track. Your way to kind of find that fulfillment is through others. It's to kind of create a startup, to create a product that helps others. I think that's the most amazing part of being an entrepreneur, that at the end, you're kind of on this kind of never-ending race to solve someone else's problem. So look at that with, embrace that, basically. Ties into what we said earlier, like, as an entrepreneur, you need to embrace the fact that kind of the finish line never finishes, and that, like, the goalpost is always moving away from you. And that's, in a sense, a good thing.
And you have to, in order to get there, you have to talk with others.
Exactly.
You have to really engage and understand.
Exactly.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts you'd like to share?
In general, I mean, I love this. I mean, thank you so much for the invite. I think the kind of this proliferation that we see of podcasts, or just like these conversations, long format conversation, that we can kind of brainstorm ideas into the future and kind of see, you know, bounce back ideas. I think they're amazing. I really, really appreciate that you kind of gave me the opportunity to just kind of run through all these general thoughts that I had about the market and, like, the, you know, the space that you and I both really, really love. And hopefully that people, you know, will find this interesting.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Where can people go to learn more about you and all the work you're doing there at Echo3D?
So definitely check out www.echo3d.co. That's echo3d.co. You can find us on social media, on YouTube even. We have kind of developer workshops that we post every weekend. And also, I'm going to be physically at AWE, the first kind of in-person conference in a long time. So if you're there, definitely find me, say hello. I'm giving a talk on November 11th.
This will air right after AWE.
So hope you had an amazing AWE, everyone.
Awesome. Alon, thanks so much for this conversation. I really did enjoy it.
Thank you so much, Jason. It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Before you go, I'm going to tell you about the next episode. In it, I speak with Brian Vogelsang. Brian is the Senior Director of Product at Qualcomm, focused on Snapdragon Spaces, an XR developer platform for head-worn augmented reality. This AR development kit is built on open standards and meant to complement the efforts by Niantic's Lightship and others. Brian has a long history at Qualcomm, where he had a front row seat to the development of the mobile app ecosystem in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and the smartphone ecosystem a decade later. He pulls some lessons forward to the AR ecosystem that Qualcomm is helping to build today. I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. Please follow or subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss this or other great episodes. Until next time.